welcome to Crime Monthly Presents Evil Uncovered, where we bring you some of our most shocking stories of true life terror. This week, we're delving into the chilling world of hitchhiker horrors. So join us as we explore three cases where the promise of a lift turns into a nightmare. Listener discretion is advised. Our first story opens in 1977, where two men met for the first time in a jewellery-making class at the California Men's Colony. Lawrence Bittaker was serving time for stabbing a supermarket worker who'd tried to stop him shoplifting, while Roy Norris had been sentenced for rape. He'd only recently been released from another stint behind bars when he saw a woman walking home alone and dragged her into bushes. Bittaker and Norris being in the same place at the same time would prove to be a terrible twist of fate, the meeting of two monstrous men who'd go on to become the most sadistic serial killers in American history. As criminal profiler and serial killer expert John Douglas from the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit would later say,
"Lawrence Bittaker was the most disturbing individual I ever created a criminal profile for."
Bittaker was born in Pittsburgh in 1940 and was immediately placed into an orphanage by his parents, who'd never wanted a kid in the first place. His upbringing was disturbing, and he'd later say his adoptive mother would punish him by pulling down his trousers and stubbing cigarettes out on him. He grew into a violent teen, once pulling out a rabbit's teeth with pliers and regularly peeping into neighborhood houses. By the time he was 18, he'd committed multiple thefts and spent time in prison for a hit and run. When he was released, he returned home to find his adoptive parents had packed up and left. He was now completely alone. Meanwhile, Roy Norris was born in Colorado in 1948. Due to his mother's drug addiction, he spent much of his childhood in care and would later say he'd been abused by a long line of foster parents. At 17, he joined the Navy, but was discharged age 21 due to what they ominously termed psychological problems and would later formally be diagnosed as a schizoid personality. Over the next decade, Bittaker was constantly in and out of prison for robbery and parole violations, while the offences committed by Norris were almost always sexual. When they met behind bars that fateful day, it didn't take long for them to bond. And though Bittaker hadn't committed any known sexual offences, he was prone to violence. So when Norris began talking about attacking women, it sparked a latent interest. For the remainder of their sentences, they began plotting what they might do together when they were released. That was a day that should never have come. Bittaker had been diagnosed as borderline psychopathic, and one psychiatrist warned he was a man who would kill without hesitation or remorse. Other psychiatric evaluations came to the same conclusion, saying,
"This man cannot be rehabilitated and will always present a clear danger to the public."
It's hard to imagine why then, but Bittaker was indeed released. And in 1979, he and Norris moved to LA, where they set about making their fantasies a reality. Fantasies that involved the kidnap and rape of teenage girls. The first thing the men did was buy a van with a sliding door, as the pair had worked out that while one of them pulled alongside girls, the other could quickly bundle them inside the vehicle. They installed a bed in the rear and placed a toolbox beneath it, which contained, among other things, pliers, a hammer and an ice pick, everyday tools that would become instruments of the worst torture imaginable. They also added a police scanner to evade law enforcement and a cooler full of drinks to lure in unsuspecting hitchhikers. They called the vehicle Murder Mac, and for the next few months, they used it to pick up hitchhikers, letting those women live as they practiced how they would lure their future victims. On June the 24th, 1979, at 7:45 p.m., they were ready to put their murderous plan into action for the first time. The evil duo's chosen victim was Lucinda Schaefer. Loved by all those who knew her, the bright and studious 16-year-old had been at a church meeting in Redondo Beach, California, when she started walking home in the cooling evening air. Bittaker showed no emotion when he later recounted the events that followed.
"We were driving around the beach area, smoking weed and photographing girls when we spotted a girl walking down the street. She was blonde and pretty and alone, so I drove up behind her. Roy said, 'Hey, want a ride? Want some grass?' She said no and kept walking. I drove ahead of her, did a U-turn, and parked on the side of the road that she was walking down. She came down the street and Roy jumped out and grabbed her. He closed the door and I drove up the hill.
Bitica had attended a youth camp in the San Gabriel Mountains growing up, and this is where they took Lucinda, accessing the remote area via an old fire road they'd discovered. The devout teenager prayed as they took turns to assault her, only for Bitica to callously tell her,
"God isn't here, only us devils."
Bitica would later talk about Lucinda's immense bravery in the face of their depravity, saying,
"She displayed a magnificent state of self-control and composed acceptance of the conditions of which she had no control. She shed no tears."
Lucinda knew she was going to die and asked only to be allowed to pray before that happened. Norris then tried to strangle her but couldn't go through with it. As he vomited outside the van, Bitica showed no human emotion as he throttled the teenager with a coat hanger and pliers. The men then wrapped her in a shower curtain and threw her body into a canyon for the wild animals. They'd committed their first murder, and it had sparked an almost crazed desire to do it again. It was just 2 weeks later when they laid eyes on 18-year-old Andrea Hall, who was hitchhiking in the searing heat along the Pacific Coast Highway. Before they could approach her, she got into another car so the men followed until she was dropped off. Norris hid in the back of the van while Bitica drove up and engaged Andrea in conversation. He invited her to grab a cold drink from the cooler in the back, and that's when Norris pounced. Andrea put up a fierce struggle, but was eventually subdued, tied up and driven into the bleak mountains. There, the men took Polaroids of her ordeal as they repeatedly assaulted her. Finally, Bitica thrust an ice pick into her ear before strangling her. It was an escalation in sadism that would come to characterize their future killings. Their third attack took place on September the 3rd, when the remorseless killers spotted 15-year-old Jackie Gilliam and 13-year-old Jacqueline Lamp waiting at a bus stop near Hermosa Beach. The men offered them a lift, but when the girls realized they were heading towards the mountains, they attempted to flee. One of the girls managed to get out of the vehicle, but the men caught up with her and convinced onlookers she was simply having a bad drugs trip. As that van door closed once more, the girls were punched into submission, bound and gagged, and the men continued their drive into the lonely mountains. The girls were held for almost 2 days, during which time they were repeatedly raped and tortured with implements from the toolbox. The men forced the girls to smile as they took photographs and recorded their rapes on cassette. Finally, Jackie was attacked with an ice pick and Jacqueline with a hammer before they were strangled and their bodies dumped in the remote mountains. These men truly were the devils Bitica had claimed them to be.
Happy Halloween!
Trick or treat!
Their final victim was 16-year-old Shirley Ledford, who accepted a lift on Halloween night 1979, perhaps because she recognized Bitica as a customer at the restaurant where she worked part-time. During a remorseless 48 hours, the pair's violence escalated unimaginably, and Shirley's horrifying ordeal was again captured on tape. This time, because Norris had to get to work, and because Bitica wanted to see how the public would react, they left Shirley's naked and mutilated body not in the mountains, but on someone's suburban front lawn. A month later, Norris met up with an old prison associate and told him what he and Bitica were doing. The horrified ex-con informed police, and after they realized the crimes matched with girls going missing in the local area, officers began tailing Norris. They were also able to locate a girl who'd been raped by two men in a van, but let go, and everything changed when she identified Norris and Bitica from a lineup. Officers pulled Norris over and searched his car. Finding drugs inside, they were able to arrest him on a parole violation. Bitica was picked up next, and a police search of his home uncovered a stash of hundreds of photographs. Many were of girls who had no idea they'd been photographed while innocently going about their business, but there were also photos of girls known to be missing. And there was yet more incriminating evidence to be found. When police searched their van, they found a tape still in the cassette player. the men had been listening to their recording of Shirley's attack. Realizing there was no way out, Norris started talking. He admitted wanting to rape girls, but said Bittaker was behind the killings. In February 1980, Norris took a plea deal. In exchange for the death penalty being taken off the table, he agreed to testify against Bittaker and help police recover the bodies of their victims. Bittaker refused to help the police and was charged with 29 counts, including kidnap, rape and murder. Bittaker went on trial in January 1981, and in the hushed courtroom, Norris recounted the dreadful crimes they had committed together. Then the court listened to the recording of Shirley's torture and rape.
It was the most devastating testimony the jury had ever heard. The agonizing screams of teenager Lynette Ledford as she was being tortured in a moving van. It was simply all too much for one juror who openly wept while spectators rushed from the courtroom. One shocked juror later said,
"I've heard screams before and I thought I'd be able to sit and listen, but I've never heard anything like that in my life."
On February the 17th, 1981, Lawrence Bittaker was found guilty of murder, kidnap, rape, sodomy, and unlawful possession of a firearm and sentenced to death. Norris was sentenced to 45 years to life and became eligible for parole in 2009. He refused to attend the hearing, and that automatically deferred his eligibility for another decade. In 2019, he was denied parole and he died behind bars just a year later. In 2019, Bittaker also died of natural causes, age 79. A year earlier, he had shown a small degree of shame over his actions, perhaps for the first time ever, saying,
"Back then, I didn't care about what I'd done. I had no remorse whatsoever. But then I had a heart attack, and it frightened me. I wondered if it wasn't kind of a taste, maybe, of the fear my victims had gone through. Just a small taste of what I had done to others."
The crimes committed by the Toolbox Killers remain some of the most horrifying in U.S. history. Over the course of 5 short months, they brought terror to Southern California and brutally ended the lives of 5 teenage girls with bright futures ahead of them. Their crimes have lingered long in the memories of the quiet neighborhoods they made their hunting ground. It's a story all who hear can never forget. For our second story, we leave the isolated mountains of California and journey to the Australian outback. This expansive and treacherous terrain has long been a mecca for backpackers seeking adventure. But in the late 1980s and early 1990s, there was someone else out there on those dusty roads. A predator who was just waiting for hitchhikers to cross his path. In September 1990, two runners stumbled upon a body in Belanglow State Forest in New South Wales, Australia. Little did they know that their discovery would unravel a mystery that had haunted the outback for years.
To local news now, and police have found a second body just 30 meters away from the one discovered by joggers earlier today. They were identified as British nationals, Caroline Clark and Joanne Walters, who went missing 5 months ago on their way to a fruit-picking job. 22-year-old Joanne had suffered multiple stab wounds, while 21-year-old Caroline had been shot 10 times in the head. Police believe she may have been used as target practice.
Numerous backpackers had gone missing in the same area over the years, and over the next few months, 5 more bodies were discovered. In October 1993, bones were found in a remote area of the forest, leading police to discover the bodies of 19-year-old Deborah Everist and 19-year-old James Gibson. They had gone missing on December 30th, 1989, after leaving Sydney to go to a festival. James had been stabbed 8 times, and in a truly horrifying act, his spine had been cut, which would have left him paralyzed and helpless. Deborah's skull had been fractured in 2 places, her jaw was broken, and she had been stabbed. On November the 1st, another skeleton was found by police searching the forest. It was identified as 21-year-old Simone Schmiedel from Germany, who hadn't been seen since she left Sydney on January the 20th, 1991, to travel to Melbourne. Once again, a post-mortem determined her spine had been severed sometime before she'd been stabbed to death. Clothes found at that scene led police to the shallow graves of 2 more missing backpackers 3 days later. 21-year-old Gabor Neugebauer and 20-year-old Anja Habschied, a couple from Germany, had last been seen on December the 26th, 1991. Gabor had been shot 6 times in the head, while Anja had been decapitated. Chillingly, her skull was never found. There was evidence that each of the couples had been abducted and held captive for some time, and police believe someone had camped out near where the bodies were found. All the victims had been tortured for a sustained period, leaving their bodies covered in appalling injuries. There were signs of sexual assault on the women. The agony these young people endured in their final hours was beyond comprehension, and it seemed to be the work of the same offender. With each passing day, the urgency to capture the elusive killer grew, casting a shadow of dread over the outback. A special task force was assembled, and their first breakthrough came on November the 13th, when police received a call from a man named Paul Onions from Birmingham, England. He told them he had escaped from a man with a gun 3 years earlier, and could describe both the perpetrator and his vehicle. Paul's nightmare began one ordinary day in 1990, when a silver Nissan 4x4 stopped for him as he hitchhiked along the Hume Highway. As they neared the Boulanglo State Forest, the driver, a stocky man with a thick handlebar moustache, stopped the car on the pretense of getting some cassette tapes out of the boot. However, Paul thought the man was behaving strangely and was alert to danger. So, when the driver pulled a gun, the young man was ready and made a run for it. The man started shooting as Paul zigzagged down the highway, trying desperately to escape the bullets and flag down cars. No one stopped, and a terrified Paul was forced to stand directly in the path of a car. The female driver braked hard and Paul jumped in, shouting,
"He's got a gun! Drive! He's got a gun!"
The woman took him to the local police station, where they told officers everything that had happened out on the road. Paul was told he had a lucky escape. When he returned to Sydney, he advised every other traveller he met not to risk hitchhiking out near the forest. That was the last he heard of it until 3 years later, when the UK newspapers began reporting on a murderer loose in the Australian outback.
Australian police are hunting for a man they believe is responsible for the murders of seven backpackers in the Boulanglo Forest area of New South Wales. Dubbed the Beast of the Bush, authorities are appealing for anyone with information to contact them.
Paul was convinced the beast the papers were talking about was the man who had tried to abduct and shoot him 3 years earlier, so he phoned Australian authorities. Incredibly, one of the officers he had spoken to back then still had a notebook containing a description of the car, plus facts Paul had said the man told him, that he worked at the Roads and Traffic Authority and was of Yugoslavian descent. When police released the details, someone called the hotline to give them the name of a man who owned a similar car and was known to keep firearms. That man was Ivan Millett, and he had been on the police radar for some time. Ivan Millett was the fifth of 14 children. He had been imprisoned multiple times, usually for theft, and had narrowly escaped being convicted for the rape at gunpoint of two hitchhikers in 1971. There were 10 Millett boys, and most of them had been in and out of prison. The boys all looked out for each other, except for Ivan. He didn't share the same familial loyalty, often sleeping with his brother's girlfriends and letting them take the blame for his crimes. His older brother later said,
"Ivan was a psychopath from the age of 10. He once cut a dog in half with a machete, and I knew it was just a matter of time before he did something terrible."
Police discovered Millett had not been at work on the day Paul was attacked, and he had also asked his neighbour to patch up a bullet hole on his Nissan, saying it had been shot during a hunting trip. Further investigation showed Millett was unaccounted for at the times of all the Boulanglo murders, and he had sold his car not long after the bodies had started turning up in the forest. Convinced they had their man, the police asked Paul to fly to Australia, where he picked Millett out of a video lineup. Now, police had all they needed to arrest him. On May the 22nd, 1994, 50 officers surrounded his house, and a negotiator told him to come out with his hands up. Millett reportedly took his time and sounded thoroughly bored when he finally appeared and was taken away. Millett was charged with robbery and weapons offences relating to Paul's attack on May the 23rd, but there was much more to come. When police searched his property, they found an abundance of incriminating evidence, including firearms and knives. Most damning of all would be the discovery of belongings from the murdered backpackers, including sleeping bags, foreign currency, clothing, identification documents, and cameras. A week after his arrest, Millett was charged with the murders of the seven backpackers. Millett's trial began at the Supreme Court of New South Wales on March the 26th, 1996, and he was soon caught lying on the stand. As well as trying to incriminate various of his brothers, Millett claimed he had never had the distinctive handlebar moustache Paul Onions had described, but an ex-colleague came forward to say he did. and he had photos to prove it. Millett was found guilty on July the 27th and given a life sentence without the possibility of parole on each of the seven murders. He was also convicted of the attempted murder, false imprisonment and robbery of Paul Onions, for which he received a further 18 years. Psychologists consider Millett to have been a sadistic psychopath motivated by inflicting pain. One criminologist said,
"This person has fallen so far short of what we consider to be normative human behaviour. He even falls short of normal criminality, which is done for opportunity, gain, status, or insult. This person engaged in homicide for their own psychological gratification. It's natural that we want to know what went wrong."
Even behind bars, Millett would continue attempting to manipulate others for his own gain. Over the years, he swallowed razor blades and staples, as well as going on hunger strike. He also cut off the little finger of his left hand, which he planned to post to the High Court of Australia in a bizarre bid to secure an appeal against his sentence. Many believe Millett killed more victims, and he was questioned many times over the years. But tragically, he never confessed to anything else before succumbing to stomach and throat cancer on October the 27th, 2019. Selfishly, he chose not to bring that form of closure to relatives desperate to know what might have happened to loved ones who went missing over those dark years. Even now, many choose to steer clear of certain areas of the Australian outback, not knowing who could be out there. After all, there are those who believe Millett couldn't possibly have acted alone.
Crime Monthly magazine is dedicated to all things true crime, where you'll find all the latest news, in-depth features, interviews with leading experts, and so much more. We've even got your essential entertainment guide for the month ahead. Buy in all good shops and supermarkets or subscribe now at greatmagazines.co.uk.
For our final tale of roadside terror, we head to 1970s California, where a serial killer would abduct and murder six young students in a dreadful killing spree before turning his rage on the one person who should have looked after him. It was against the advice of hospital psychiatrists to release Edmund Kemper on parole in 1969. It was on his 21st birthday that the authorities made the decision to give him his freedom, only 5 years after he'd shot both his grandparents to death. But what could have prompted such a terrible act of violence? Born on December the 18th, 1948, in Burbank, California, Kemper grew up in a chaotic household. His mother, Clarnell, constantly berated her husband until eventually he walked out, divorcing his wife in 1957. After that, Clarnell seemed to turn her hostility and unhappiness onto her only son. She moved the family to Montana, but while Kemper's two sisters were treated well, his mother blamed him for all her ills. She routinely told him he was worthless, as well as mocking his appearance and calling him a weirdo. When he was 10 years old, Kemper was made to sleep in a locked basement, away from his sisters in case he hurt them. Terrified of the dark and the rats, the only light in his dank prison was from a gas furnace. The flickering flames cast eerie shadows in the basement, making young Kemper feel as though he was staring into the very mouth of hell. The torment he endured as a child may have laid the foundations for the horrific acts that were to come in his teenage years, or maybe his mother had real reason to worry, as Kemper was already exhibiting deeply dark behaviour. He was just 10 years old when he buried one of the family cats alive before digging up its body and decapitating it. He stabbed another cat to death aged 13. His favourite game, apart from cutting off the heads of his sister's dolls, was to get the girls to tie him to a chair where he would simulate being gassed to death. At the age of 15, his mother sent him to live with his paternal grandparents on their farm in North Fork, California. His grandfather, who was also called Edmund, was the only person Kemper ever loved, as he was the only person who paid him any attention. But his grandmother Maud had a similar personality to his mother. She was verbally abusive to the now teenager, and on August the 27th, 1964, Kemper would pick up a rifle and shoot her dead at the kitchen table. He then waited for his grandfather to come home before shooting him as well, to spare him the suffering of finding his wife dead. The teenager was sent to a hospital for the criminally insane, where he baffled doctors. Although found to be a paranoid schizophrenic, he was not clinically insane by their understanding of the word, and came across as a model prisoner. After 6 years, he was considered no threat to himself or others and was released, but Kemper would later admit that he had mimicked being mentally healthy and memorized tests, so he came out with perfect scores. The one thing he'd kept all to himself were the increasingly violent fantasies that ran through his head. Despite warnings against it, Kemper was released back into the care of his mother in Santa Cruz. Their relationship remained abusive as Kemper attempted to find his place in the world. He went to college, then began working for the Department of Transportation. But when a motorcycle crash left him unable to work, his mind turned once again to fantasies of murder. Using a large payout from his accident, he bought himself a car and then he went out hunting for hitchhikers. Kemper would first test himself by picking them up and then letting them go without hurting them. But he increasingly pushed the boundaries and would later confess,
"I'm driving along and we go to a vulnerable place where no one is watching. Then I tell myself, no, I can't kill them. But there was an awful rage consuming my insides. I was playing a dangerous game with a loaded gun, and it got us all."
What would later be dubbed the Coed murders began in May 1972. Kemper's first two victims, Mary Ann Pache and Anita Luchessa, were both 18 years old, and one can only imagine the fear and confusion that gripped those young women as they realized their fate after Kemper offered them a lift. The fledgling killer would go on to stab them to death before putting them in the boot of his car, but his inexperience almost got him caught. He would later tell police that stabbing them had taken far longer than he'd thought it would, and he was in a shocked daze when he drove away, only to be stopped by police because one of his backlights was out. Kemper's affable manner meant the police didn't open his boot to check his lights. Perhaps if they had, Kemper would not have gone on to become one of the most notorious killers in history. Instead, he took the bodies back to his home where he decapitated them and had sex with their body parts. The next day, he dumped them in the woods and discarded his bloodied clothing. After that, Kemper learned from his mistakes and became a more efficient killer. His next four victims were 15-year-old Eiko Ku in September 1972, 19-year-old Cindy Shawl in January 1973, and 23-year-old Rosalind Thorpe and 21-year-old Alice Liu in February 1973. Despite being 6'9" tall, Kemper would pick up petite victims because they were easier to control. He would keep them calm by telling them he wouldn't hurt them before going on to strangle, stab, or shoot them. But Kemper managed to keep on luring victims and evade capture because he just didn't fit anyone's idea of a killer. When he offered girls a lift, some even talked to him about the campus murderer because they felt so comfortable with him. It also helped that his mother worked at the university as an admin assistant. Students had been told not to get into a stranger's car unless they had a college staff sticker, but that just played straight into his hands. No one had any idea that Kemper was murdering, dismembering and sexually violating his victims. He once bid good morning to a neighbour while carrying a decapitated head in a bag. He also buried one head outside his mother's bedroom window, later laughing as he explained how his mother had always wanted people to look up to her. He became confident and cocky, taking ever-increasing risks. The police had no leads and he felt invincible. Kemper had wanted to become a police officer himself, but he exceeded the maximum height, so he'd contented himself with hanging out at a local cop bar. There, the officers chatted to him, and he even picked up a few tips to avoid getting caught. He was tempted to attend a memorial service for one of his victims, but knew police would survey the crowd looking for her killer. But the rage was building like a tidal wave, and he was about to commit his final acts of violence, this time directed towards the person he saw as the reason for all his deviant acts. In a later jailhouse interview, he would reveal,
"I said to myself, it's not going to happen to any more girls. It's got to stay between me and my mother. I said, she's got to die, or I've got to die, or more girls are going to die. And that's when I decided, I'm going to murder my mother. I knew a week before she died that I was going to kill her."
On the 20th of April 1973, Kemper's mother came home from a party and retired to bed. In the early hours of the morning, when he was sure she was asleep, Kemper went into her room. In one jailhouse interview, he recalled what happened next.
"I waited until around 5:15 in the morning, and then I went and found a claw hammer and my pocket knife, the same one I'd used to kill Mary Ann. I carried the knife in my right hand and the hammer in my left hand as I walked very quietly into my mother's bedroom. I hit her just above the temple on her right side of the head. I struck her with a very hard blow, and immediately after striking that blow, I looked for a reaction, and there really wasn't one.
Kemper would go on to cut off his mother's head and use it for sex. He then put her head on a shelf and screamed at it for an hour while throwing darts at it, as well as cutting out her tongue and larynx and putting them in the waste disposal. He later said,
"It all seemed kind of appropriate, as much as she'd bitched and screamed and yelled at me over so many years."
Kemper's spree was almost over, but he still had one loose end to tie up. He suspected his mother's best friend, Sally Hallett, would immediately know it was him who'd killed her when the horrifying news got out, so he invited her over to the house. When she arrived, he strangled her and hid her body in a cupboard. After that final act of violence, he got in his car with an arsenal of guns and drove for 3 days, listening to the radio and waiting to hear that he was a wanted man. But it never happened. No one had any idea of the crimes he'd committed. Eventually, he stopped at a phone box in Colorado and called the Santa Cruz Police Department. With a chilling calmness, he confessed that not only were there two bodies in his apartment, but he was also the notorious co-ed killer. He then stood by the phone box, arms resting on the top, and waited for the sirens to start wailing in the distance. After his arrest, Kemper didn't stop talking. He confessed to all the murders and took detectives to where the bodies were buried. Throughout, he was calm, helpful, and pleasant. Kemper was what we now think of as a textbook serial killer. The mother fixation, the warped sexual fantasies, and the young female victims. But that's perhaps because he was the first to be interviewed by the FBI. Kemper was brought to life in Netflix's Mindhunter, based on the work of Behavioral Science Unit FBI agents John Douglas and Robert Ressler, who studied him to help them catch similar predators. Kemper's confessions were horribly detailed due to his photographic memory. He had a genius-level IQ of 145, which meant his retellings were cohesive and he could explain his motivation, techniques, and even understand what drove him. Kemper knew the slain women represented his mother, and he wanted to control his victims, since he had no control over her. He also didn't have a clue how to instigate the romantic relationships he yearned for. Kemper's extensive interviews with FBI agents helped them understand the mindset of a serial killer and contributed significantly to the development of criminal profiling techniques. Now in his 70s, Kemper remains incarcerated and has turned down parole hearings as he's happy in prison. He still believes responsibility for his crimes lies with his mother, saying,
"Six young women dead because of the way she raised her son, but I still loved her. It's not rational, it's painful, and I still live with that."
Ed Kemper managed to evade capture for nearly a decade, bringing terror to Santa Cruz. His victims are remembered for the women they were and mourned for all they could have become. That's all from this week's episode. Thank you for joining us and be sure to tune in next time when we'll be bringing you three more tales of true life terror. Evil Uncovered is brought to you by Bauer Media. Concept and original stories by Steph Seelan and Lisa Howells. Episode written and exec produced by Lisa Howells. Produced and edited by Rick Simmons. AI voices produced and edited by Waldemar Matwash. Episode created with support from WeDaVinci AI Technology.